Okay, going on. This is an interview with Leonard Boswick and
Mike Burns.
Mike Burns, okay. One thing I wanted to get at to begin with is why we went to liquid over solid propellant engines. Some of the parameters involved there, and something about, I've got just a note jotted down here, the I-specific barrier of 260 on solid. Does that mean anything? What's significant about that?
Well, the reason we went to liquids was that the liquids are easier to control or wear at the tank.
Yeah.
There was a lot of trouble with control of the solids. Also, the liquids were able to give us a higher specific impulse so that you could get more output for the amount of weight that you were carrying of fuel. So that kept the size within bounds.
I think one other very important point, too, is the fact that, as I recall it, back at the time we developed the big booster engines, that the state-of-the-art had actually advanced further in liquid as opposed to solid.
Yeah, we did not have the capability at that time, demonstrated at least, of large solid.
We figured, really, that probably the most economical way to go, as a matter of fact, because the R&D would have been involved in developing big solid boosters. The specific impulse is a big thing.
Yeah, one other thing that certainly played a part in is that we had available a history of working with liquids up through the Redstone and Jupiter engines. And we could take for the first Saturn a modification of the Jupiter engines and the Jupiter tanks and the Redstone tanks.
Right.
That combination allowed us to get large payloads up to find out what else we were going to need. Much quicker than we could have been going the other way.
And when you got into an engine of the F1 caliber, there was no solid that came anywhere near that.
No, not at that time. And the F1 was partly an outgrowth of some development work that had already been done on the E1, which was an Air Force funded.
I've got a question on
that.
Well, I've got a question on it further down the line, but as long as we're into it, can we stop there? Because now, I've got two dates kind of for the F1, and maybe the C1 helps explain the discrepancy. One date is 55 and the other date is 58 when the F1 development started. Can you help me on that at all?
The actual F1.
What's the date that we started on
the F1? Okay, I was going to tell you that the actual F1 contract date was January 9th, 1959. That began the actual contractual coverage for development of a large booster engines for
as far as NASA.
Yeah. Now, at first, on January 9th, 1959, we contracted for a 1,000,000-pound thrust booster engine. Now, at that time, it wasn't really even called the F1. All I knew was that in order to go into orbit, make a landing on the moon, we would need a large space vehicle. And I don't think at that time it was even called Saturn. I don't believe it was.
It had not been defined.
But it was January 9th, 1959, when the problem started.
That's contractually.
Yeah.
Now, ARPA had a contract, and they had the first part of this one he's talking about also, which we picked up. I think you're talking about the date we picked it up, right?
No, we picked it up. That's correct.
Yeah.
Prior to that, see, it was working out of ARPA. Now, before that even, the Air Force had the engine that was the E-1, which was, I believe, a 500, it was either 400,000 or 500,000. I've forgotten. It's been so long ago. I can find it out if it's pertinent.
No, not necessarily.
But they had started this with Rocketdyne, again, thinking that, you know, they were in the business of the ballistic missiles, and they didn't know what size engines they may have to go to there. They were perhaps looking at replacing the two with one or something of that sort. I'm not sure of the background of why they did it. But because that had been started, there was some tooling available, there was a certain amount of development activity, some hardware had been made,
right,
that gave them a start, which indicated that was possibly the quickest way we could get to one of the sites that we needed. And of course, ARPA started the first contract, we picked it up. The first people working on it were ones that had been out of, either from headquarters moved out there, or ones that were hired by them. Then when NASA picked it up, we set up an office there with some
that gave you pretty good momentum because they, since they already had some hardware on the
stand. They had some hardware, not capable of the million pound, but certainly capable of demonstrating what you could do with large turbo machinery. They had gotten into the casting, some of the metallurgical problems they would have. They had built some injectors that would, so they had some injector concepts that were not finalized, but at least they had some ideas of what would be required for the large thing. We built on that. And I believe that's one reason they got off to a good start.
Raised the question here. When we were out talking to people at Rocketdyne once, I remember one of the guys, I think he was talking about the F-1, he said in the early development stage, they're going through the normal teething problems and so on. And they said, you know, they finally got it to run a little bit more smoothly. But I think the comment was made, it's almost kind of like a black art. You're working on several different things at once, and finally it comes together, and you're not sure exactly which fix was the one that did the job, and so you just freeze it right there.
Right, you freeze it.
It's just kind of a guessing. You're not really sure which one did it. Is that a reasonable way to characterize it?
It's not. I don't like to hear it called quite that way because what it really is you have a set of pretty well-defined development portions, subsystems, and parts being developed for a concept that all goes together, you think, by your analysis, will be correct. Then for each part that you're not sure will work, in other words, you have not yet had experience, and you haven't had anything quite like it, you will usually have one or two alternates, and they will be going along also. Now, in the process of this black art, as was mentioned, what you're doing, you're putting together some of the parts that, and maybe that doesn't quite work, so then you already have one coming along, which is not just happenstance, but plan that if this doesn't quite do it, maybe this will, and for very good technical reasons, and then you'll put those together. And then when you get something that will allow the thing to get through the transition or begin to get through the transition, you'll see it's either building up too fast or the flame front is too far away from the face of the injector, or it's burning properly in the center but ragged on the edge, or the other way, if you've got some hot spots. And all you do there, then you begin to say, okay, when I have this now, do I change my pattern of the flow of the liquids through and the way that the spray is spread out, or do I change the flow rates, or do I put a larger pressure drop in the injector itself? But more cooling capability in the walls of the chamber, things like this. Now that's where your black art comes in, because for each one of these you change, it will change some other things in the whole system, and you've got to balance that out. Now that's where the black art comes in. But it's not quite like you're taking a bunch of things that you don't know what they'll do. You know what each of these will do, but you don't know what the combination of them will do together exactly.
Okay, that explains it better, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
So there is a certain amount of not quite being certain which things work specifically at once.
You know what each one does individually, but the combination you don't know. So you have to sometimes, like you may put a little more cooling in the wall because you had a hot spot there. When doing this, the way you normally do it is you make the tubing size a little smaller to get the flow faster through there, or you put a larger percentage through. Well, then that's going to have an effect on what's coming through the injector directly.
Yeah.
And the same with pressure drops in the injector. You can get too much, and then the flame front's in the wrong position. You don't want your flame front on the injector face, but you don't want it too far down in the chamber either, because you can have problems that way. You need to blanket it where it won't burn, so you gotta get that problem.
Okay, well, that kind of helps
help
understand the, that remark then, because that's always kind of intrigued me and bothered me.
Well, I think he's right in a way, as far as the balancing out gets to be very difficult, and it's much more difficult in the hydrogen engines for the final balance than it is in the other ones, although hydrogen works for you as a fuel better than kerosene. Hydrogen is so kind to you that it will burn over such a wide range that you can make things work that will lull you into believing you're in real good shape. But when you get further along in the development, you find out it doesn't quite do what it's supposed to because of the wide range. Now, the kerosene, if it's used in a case, it either works or doesn't. Real quick, no, you have to change
yeah. Okay, engines have always been called the longest lead time article. And I wonder if you could generalize about that and explain some of the reasons why.
Well, there's, I think, two good reasons. One of them is that you really cannot size the internal parts of the system for the stages until you know what the engine demands are going to be. If you know the thrust that you're looking for in an engine, fine. You can build a thrust structure for the stage. You can build a tank size, but you don't know the flow rates. You don't really know how much, what size piping you're going to do. You don't know what kind of arresting you're going to have. You don't know what kind of, in other words, what kind of screens you'll need for the particle size that the engine can ingest without having trouble. So you got to know that much about the engine before you can do very much with the stage, for one thing. Another thing you got to know is you got to know how long is the engine going to be burning, so you know the size of the tanks, what rate is flowing, and how long it's going to be burning. Now, you can calculate what it should be, but until you're able to get an engine that's far enough along that you know that's what it's going to be, you may have to have the thing burn longer, which means you design the tank differently. So the tank is, I'm saying tank means not meaning that portion of the stage. And the stage has some more, a lot more activities
right.
than that. But
right.
but the portion that is the heart of how they put everything together at the stage has to depend on knowing pretty well what the engine's going to require. So the first thing you do in the development of an engine is, I mean, of a vehicle at least, has been consistently that way. And I think it's pretty much that way in aircraft too. You start a development of an engine of a certain size and type and certain capabilities. When it gets far enough along that it appears that it's going to do that, then you begin to say, okay, with that, I now need a stage to do this, and you get the stage contractor going. That's the general first reason. The second reason is that unlike the stage, you cannot test an engine by a simple pressurization of the thing to see if the thing is structurally proper or not. You've got to run it because it's all moving machinery and it acts differently in that environment than any other way that you can run to it. You've got to run that thing and find out where the weakest links are so that you'll see what changes you have to make. We start the engine developments quite early. And we get into this testing capability and we will rework parts, and we keep that going, incidentally, all the way through the program until we have gotten enough time so that the whole mission possibilities, every part in the engine is seen at least that length of time before it ever flies for that length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you don't have to do with the stages. They can do most of their testing with static testing.
Pressure testing,
they do have to do some dynamic testing, so I don't want to take anything away from the stage,
yeah.
but they've got a job to do.
They can still.
But it's something can be done
yeah.
much simpler and shorter time, and it's once you've done it on the ground, you say, okay, that's fine. You can't do that with the engines. And so that's why they're long sleeved up. It's those two reasons.
Okay, good. That helps me a lot there. Let me ask then about the philosophy of the induced combustion instability.
Okay, why
it's done, and the earlier applications in other engine programs prior to Saturn, how it came in, why, and so on.
Okay, the first that I'm aware of was done on the Redstone. Now, the why that it's done, now there may have been some point. I know that was done on the Redstone. I don't know of any before that myself.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason it's done is that if you have combustion instability, it's usually something that happens only under very transient conditions. And you can have one engine exactly the same design, built supposedly to the same drawings, that will be fine and the next one would not be. And you can't have that because you would be in a situation where you'd have a catastrophic failure if you get the instability in it, and
even
it doesn't dampen out.
Even these minute variations in the same manufacturing process may cause
if one is subject to instability, it can be right on the threshold, and you won't, you know, it'll be one would have it and the next one not. That's that type of thing. So the, what you do with the induced instability is you deliberately disturb the flame front, and you find out, will it dampen itself out? And you have a criteria of what, how much can you stand before structural damage. Then you set that as a requirement, and it becomes mandatory that all of the engines be tested by demonstrating that. Now, there's quite an art to doing that. You have to get just exactly the right bomb size. You got to get it in the right location. You got to be able to force the instability,
mm-hmm.
And you got to play around with it a little bit, because sometimes we found, for example, that you'd have a large disturbance, and it would recover real quickly and be fine. Particularly with this true on J2, you took a small disturbance, a very small bomb, and it didn't recover. So it was very sensitive to small variations, where you would have thought it would be more sensitive to the larger. So it's that sort of thing. But the induced stability, instability, is done to give you a feeling of where the margin is, because you might be operating in a regime that is right at a point where a very small change in the flow, like something blocking a tube or something in the injector, or a momentary surge in the pressure so that you get a little difference in the flow, could conceivably cause you to have this instability start. And if it starts, it doesn't dampen out, being real problems. So what they do is they get a series of tests early in the program to find out what it takes to trigger it and what it takes to dampen it out. And then after you've gotten enough data of a range of information there, then you say, okay, now in all my production engines, I'm going to do that as part of the acceptance. And it becomes part of the reliability.
Yes, so do you actually go through the induced combustion instability in each of the production engines?
We did it on some of them. We didn't do it on all of them. But the concept is that you have to demonstrate that. So you can do it two ways. You can demonstrate it by enough testing development-wise to show that you can never have it with that particular design. But we even went further than that. We did put it on some production engines, and we also put it on some production engines and stage combinations in a couple of cases, just to be real sure. And that's an added safety because of, again, the system together may operate slightly different than it did as an individual engine fed different.
I think one important thing to say too is the fact that on each one of our production engines, we did have a hot fire. That was required.
Yes, on all engines.
Did you do that on a battleship? In a battleship condition, or was that a hot fire? With the
hot fire, in general rule, was
on the battleship for us delivered to be sure that the stage is getting an engine that doesn't have any known defects, and then to check the stage engine combination, every stage is fired.
That's right. Actually, both. So, in other words, what they did was, for example, with the F1, they would actually deliver to Edwards, and they would fire that engine individually, as Len says, but when they put it in the stage would then be fired in combination with five engines.
Right. And every stage was fired at MTF or SACTA or wherever.
We had some fired here.
But even later on, downstream, all the stages
all
were
the stages
fired
were
once
fired.
Before they
fired.
Got down. Okay.
And I want to emphasize the reason for that is that without firing that stage as a combination, you could have the problem that is the human error. Someone could have inadvertently left something in the system that was missed.
In the stage itself, yeah. In the
stage engine combination after the hookup.
Right.
Each one is individually bought off, separately, supposedly perfect. They've made it again, but you can have such things as somebody leaving something in there.
Yeah.
What do you say?
What's that word mean?
Hey, Tim.
Okay, I'll give you a call.
Okay.
See you later.
There was a lot of testing of H1 engines at Marshall Space Flight Center. I'm almost beginning to see the answer to this one. But not so much on the RL-10, the F1, the J2. And why was that?
Okay, I'll tell you real simple on the H1 versus F1. Two things involved there. Three things. One of them was that, of course, the program, when it started, the H1 program was an outgrowth of the S3D Jupiter engine and
right.
the one for the already had the capability pretty well in hand here, and it was a recognized team already available. There were both contractor and government people here. So in the early part of the thing, as it went into the H-1 engine, they did a lot of testing there to find out more about the H-1 engine than what you would find out in the normal amount of testing. In other words, there were a lot of limits testing, a lot of other concepts of things, whether the weak things known as to whether or not, sort of a backup to the contractor's effort in case something went wrong in the weaker areas. So we did a lot of that. Now, we didn't do this much on the F-1 because the similarity of the fuel combination. Now, we used the H-1 to test some things that we thought might happen on the F-1 in the larger size. Although the size difference was there, it was calculated what would you have to do in the way of changing certain combinations of the operating parameters for the H-1 to at least find out whether that's likely to be a problem on the F-1. So it was used in some cases to prevent having to run an F-1, which costs so much more to run. When you think about the large amount of fuel.
There were some other considerations too. For I think for one thing, the size of the F-1 engine. They needed a test site fairly close to the manufacturer's plant, which was Denver's airport base.
Yeah.
Cut down a lot of shipping costs, obviously, and maybe damage the engine in transit places. But so it was relatively simple for the contractor to take the engine, say, like onto Edwards, fire it out there, and then return it to this plant for a checkup. So I think that was another consideration.
That was certainly one of the big ones for the F-1 too, because of the physical safety.
That plus acoustics, for example, and safety. You know, when they first developed the F-1, they had no idea what that engine was going to do.
You covered the other two of them.
Yeah, right. Okay. maybe I'm stealing your.
No, that's fine. You covered it well.
For example, here you have a relatively
well-populated
metropolitan area, and we didn't know what the shock wave was going to be.
If you recall, we found out with the running the H-1s here that under certain weather conditions, like we have today with a little bit overcast, you could get enough noise to cause people in Birmingham to think that they had an earthquake. We didn't have as much, surprisingly, when we ran the F-1, we didn't have near as much as we had with some of the earlier ones. It turns out it's the smoothest running as far as the sound of the engine than it is.
Is that right?
What was rather amusing, and this is kind of off the record, is that also the fact that, you know, people, of course, would submit claims against the government for any damage on broken windows. And we had one amusing thing here that happened, I guess, in Huntsville. The first time they fired, they shattered 5 loose of the S1C. A woman complained that it actually caused cracks in the plastic.
Yeah.
So, of course, each one of these cases had to be investigated. They sent a team of investigative men out there, I guess, and they actually found out these cracks. So they obviously they've been there before the station fired. But I think all these things have to be considered. Edwards Air Force Base is supposed to be isolated.
Well, that's the three reasons. One of them is the H-1 size and the fact that it could be used to duplicate some conditions that would give you answers on the F-1. The other one is the transportation. Because if anything goes wrong, you've got to take it back to the contractor. Nobody else has the facilities and the equipment to do the repair or change out the injection thing at that time. Later in the program, if we do that capability sometimes for certain components that you can remove in the field at the site. But a lot of it has to be done back to plant.
But now I was wondering about, you said it was possible to test some of the F-1 characteristics through H-1 testing. But is it easy to scale up?
It isn't, but such things as one thing you could test, for example, you could take put baffles on the injector, for example, and find out what kind of pattern you needed to get the a baffle injector to work properly.
On the H1 injector.
You do that on the H1, and then you could scale that up to the F1, and it'd have a fair chance of working.
Yeah.
And it did. Mm-hmm. Come pretty close to it. Not that much change. But you don't know, there's some things you can't do. You can't, for example, you could not run the turbo machinery except in some off-condition situations and even guess what that would do to one the size of the F-1 in comparison.
Yeah. Let me ask you something about that. When I was trying to bring myself up to speed on engines, which was still a difficult process, one of the things I came across, and which has been in my Bible at that thing by Hootsuite and Wang. Are you familiar with that? You know what I'm talking about?
I've heard of it.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted, although the illustrations in there, you know, it shows injector baffles and everything else, it doesn't tell which engines are shown. It all looks to me like H1 and F1 and J2 parts, and I just was wondering, you know, I wanted to confirm that. If you know anything about it.
I don't know whether we could say for sure that it is. I suspect
because
it.
This was
I
from
suspect.
Rocketdyne. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I suspect it, it is, but I can't. I would have to look back in the records. Now, whenever they used anything like that, they always asked for permission to publish papers and things, you know, and they had to get permission from the government for it. And I suspect that we would find, if we checked in the record, we'd find something that showed that, yes, they did ask for it and get permission. But I'm not really familiar with whether they did or not. Because at the early part of the program, I was here during the early part of the build-up of the first Saturn. Up through the Saturn 1B, the first one. In fact, I was over in charge of this assembly section and handled that portion of it. And of course, we had the engines. We did a lot of modification of engines here, but a fair amount, special instrumentation and things of this sort. It was not put on by the contractor. Things that he kind of reluctantly agreed he'd let us do, but we felt we needed to know more about it than we would be able to find out about this information, particularly on the early things like the Jupiter. We did a lot of it. And we kept that up on. And they were built here by government employees with getting, you know, just the tanks built outside and the valve built outside, the elbows, and we built here. And some of the stuff was actually built here.
Build the engines, the stages you're talking about?
Stages and part of the build up on the engine. Now, the engines were built and delivered, but we did some modifications here.
And the H1s came from Neosho, isn't
that
right?
First they came from Nova Park, and then they were moved to Neosho.
Okay.
And then Neosho was set up as
okay, I've got a question, specific question on the H-1. It's something I came across and it's been kind of open-ended. In late 66, there was a question with the Haynes Stellite turbine blade.
Very
the tracking problem.
On the H-1, yeah. And I'd like to have you comment generally about it, but one thing I'd like to know specifically, too, is that apparently these same turbine blades are used in military rockets, so they have to go back and change out all the turbine blades on those military jobs too, or what?
They're also used in aircraft, so similar situation. What happened was that we had a problem with the turbine blades just breaking unexpectedly. And the problem turned out to be that after a fairly thorough investigation, of course everybody had no way of knowing where to look for the problem. But in going into it, as we went into it, we found out that there were blades in there that were out of the wrong material. The question comes up, how do you get the wrong material? So looking at the contractor's plan, you find out that he's got across an area, like say, you say across the ceiling here, a bunch of bins with material in it, and he gets an order in, needs so many of this particular material, and he reads the thing, pulls a chain, it drops down into his pan, a bucket, and he puts the ticket in there and gives it out. Well, he apparently pulled the wrong chain,